Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dr. Nick.
Don't you be the doctor. You report the symptoms. I will determine their significance.
Mr. Evil.
Dr. Evil. I didn't spend 6 years in evil medical school to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
If they are, you know, doing some sort of medical thing to you, you want to be in the smallest room that they have, I think. You don't want to be in the largest room that they have. You know what I mean? You ever see these operating theaters that they have with, like, stadium seating? You don't want them doing anything to you that makes other doctors go, I have to see this. Are you kidding? Are they going to really do that to him? Are there seats? Can we get in? Do they scalp tickets to these things?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
313-580-CFRA. We're a little late starting the program because, honestly, it's draft budget day at the city of Ottawa. A lot of homeowners in Ottawa, big day. The proposed property tax increase, 2.39%. Which is $75 per household based on the average assessed house of a little more than $300,000 in Ottawa. At 3 o'clock, I was talking to the mayor of Ottawa, Jim Watson. Pretty lengthy interview. We talked about a lot of issues, and we're going to air that right after the 4 o'clock news. It's the healthiest hour on radio right now. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday house call. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility or 1-800-580-CFRA. If you have a health-related question for Dr. Barry Dworkin, the goal over the last few weeks and going forward is to fit in as many calls as we can into this hour. So every single phone line is available right now, and encourage you to call early because usually the phone lines tend to fill up as we make our way through the hour. Flu shot.
Yes.
You're offering it at your clinic, obviously, for your patients.
Yep.
How's demand? A lot of people coming in for the flu shot?
Or? Well, we're starting this coming weekend.
Okay, so you haven't started yet?
We're waiting for delivery of the actual vaccines. So some of the offices, you make your order from the public health, and then they send you the doses.
Is this Ottawa Public Health?
It's Ottawa Public Health.
Okay.
So we're still waiting for quantities. We've had some in early for patients who are at high risk. So those that are coming in right now, those that have appointments.
Who would be considered high risk then?
People with diabetes, people over 65, those with chronic diseases, kidney disease, lung disease, heart disease, cancers. Anybody with chronic diseases usually would get pregnant women get the flu shot.
Okay.
They were the ones on the priority to get that first.
And you advocate, obviously, getting the flu shot, right?
Yeah, there's no downside to it, despite the hype, despite the misinformation out there. It's really no different than any other vaccine that we get. People will claim, hey, you know, I got the flu shot and I got sick afterwards. Well, you're giving a vaccine during a time where people are sick anyway in terms of the number and the incidence of flus and colds that are going around. And so I could be giving, you could give out 100,000 vaccines to everybody at the same time, and undoubtedly you will have people say, you know, I got a cold or I got a flu or I got something that happened to me thereafter. And I could then do the same thing and give 100,000 apples out to everybody at the same time, and invariably you will have the same number of people complaining of colds, flus, and other things right afterwards, and you wouldn't say the apple did it to you. So
right.
It's not, there's nothing in it to make you sick. There's no active virus. It's pieces of protein that your body
is it
then,
synthetic then?
No,
is
it's no? It's the flu virus. You hear the terms H and N, right? Like H1N1 or H3N2 or what? There's different combinations. These are the proteins that are on the surface of the shell that surrounds and protects the virus, the core of the virus. So if you think of a beach ball with a pencil inside the beach ball, the pencil is the genetic code of the virus. The beach ball is the shell that surrounds the virus that acts like a shield. And on the surface of that beach ball are grains of sand. Those grains of sand are the proteins. And so those proteins are H and N. So the grains of sand are H and N. And they have different shapes to them. And those shapes are different. So the body, if it hasn't seen it before, may not be able to defend itself as well. So when you are injecting the vaccine, you're injecting those grains of sand, the H and the N. So you're not injecting any of the virus at all. And your body develops antibodies to that. Yeah.
How long does that take? How long after you get the shot would you say your immunity builds up to?
Usually they're saying usually between 2 to 4 weeks afterwards.
2 to 4 weeks. Okay.
Yeah, it's not immediate.
All right. Okay.
Because when you think of when you get the flu or when you get a cold, it takes about 5 days to destroy the virus. when you get a cold, and then the symptoms linger afterwards. And that's because your body has to mount an immune response and finally destroy the virus, and it takes time. So same thing, you get the vaccine. It takes, you know, right, a few weeks.
The vaccine, is it accurate to say that the vaccine changes every year, that the modifications are made?
Sometimes it changes on the basis of best estimates about which strains will be coming to the area.
Right.
And so they'll change the proteins that are in there.
Right.
This year, I don't think there's much change at all compared to previous years. But it is, the issue right now is that it always is on the basis of what we call the epidemiology. That is what's going on in other parts of the world and what tends to come over here. What we may see in the next 5 to 10 years because of latest research that has identified a commonality between all the flu viruses, in fact, a lot of viruses where there's a common structure that they may be able to target. In fact, they've done this in animal models where they've targeted different viruses, including things like Ebola and dengue fever, and they were able to cure the mice of the disease. And so the idea is that if you get a flu outbreak or an epidemic, you won't have to start producing a different type of vaccine. You can use something that deals with all the viruses the same way. So that's something that is still ongoing in terms of study, but nevertheless quite exciting because you have a means of curing a disease.
Is it true that it's not mandatory for employees of hospitals and long-term care homes to have the flu shot? And do you think it should be?
I think it should be.
But it's not.
It is not. And I, you know, the whole idea is you want to try to reduce the risk.
Especially
bringing
a facility like that, you have so much of those chronic underlying health conditions that you talked about.
That's right. And I don't understand why people don't get flu shots when they go into those places if they're working closely with people who are sick. Right.
Who shouldn't get the flu shot?
People who are immunocompromised, for example. They're on chemotherapy.
HIV?
If they have full-blown HIV that's not being treated, you have to be careful.
Okay.
Anybody who has had a potential history of Guillain-Barré syndrome, although again, very little evidence suggests that the flu shot causes Guillain-Barré.
Egg allergies.
No, that has stopped. Egg allergies, no, is not a contraindication because the protein content from eggs which the virus is grown in is extremely low and has not been shown to cause any allergic reaction. So that actually this year was taken off the list.
Okay. Let's take some calls. John in Nepean.
Hello.
Hi, John. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about the dumping syndrome. I have this dumping syndrome. I guess that's what you call it.
Right.
I'll give you the background. I was diagnosed with stomach cancer about 40 years ago. The washings were malignant. They operated on me, took out part of my stomach.
Right.
Cut the vagus nerves and some ulcers.
Right.
I've had the dumping syndrome ever since. I go 3 or 4 times a day quite often. After the first food of the day, shredded wheat or something, I'm going to go probably within an hour.
Right.
I never know when it's going to come on me, on an airplane or wherever I am, in the car. Or I know where every washroom is in the West End.
Right.
Climbed a lot of fences. Any suggestions?
Well, this is the problem is you've had an anatomical change to the stomach. Right, they removed part of the stomach, and they did what was known as a vagotomy. And for our listeners, a vagotomy was the old way of treating ulcers. It was thought that the vagotomy means you're cutting the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is a nerve, one of the longest nerves in your body. It comes from a Latin word, means the wanderer, because the nerve wanders from the brain, goes all the way down to the intestines, and it also is involved in stimulating the stomach to secrete acid. So before the advent of medications to reduce acid content in the stomach, they did these complex surgeries called vagotomies
to do that.
And as you mentioned, this was about 40 years ago. My father had a vagotomy done too for his ulcers, and he had complications afterwards.
They,
it's not a fun thing.
They diagnosed it as cancer.
Yeah, and so if they also remove part of the stomach when they did that at the same time, it changes the way food is moved from the stomach, digested and moved from the stomach into the intestine. And so it is dependent on what you're eating. It is dependent on the quantity of food that's eaten all at once. And the tendency and the recommendations are very similar to those people now that have bariatric surgery. That is where they have either bypass surgery done to treat obesity or changes to the size of the stomach to reduce the amount of food that's in the stomach, is that the diet has to change. There are dietitians that would probably be in a better position than I am to help you, if you haven't seen them already, to help minimize the effect of this dumping syndrome, because the stomach just can't handle at times what you're giving it. And it is food dependent, it's quantity dependent, fluid dependent, and they may be able to help you. I'm sure they will be able to help you in reducing the effect that you're experiencing.
Well, say one shredded wheat in the morning, and not always, but wherever I am within an hour, right. I'm probably going to have to go.
Yeah, but
and sometimes I don't make it.
Yeah, and it may mean that you may have to change what you're eating, though. That's the issue, because there can be certain foods that will contribute more and others that may contribute less to that type of dumping syndrome. The other issue, too, is that there is a reflex that we have. It's called the gastrocolic reflex. The gastrocolic reflex, gastro meaning stomach, colic referring to this the colon. And the reflex is when you eat, there's a tendency to want to have a bowel movement afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
And for some people, it can be quite pronounced and more much stronger than for others. And depending, again, on how your digestive system is working.
It's always liquid.
Yeah, which means that you're not absorbing fluid very well from the intestine. And that's also something that may have to be looked at. If you're not able to absorb as much water, that can contribute to the problem you're having. And there's things that can be done to help further the absorption, to reduce the transit time through the colon so you don't experience that dumping syndrome.
You wouldn't suggest any medication? I've tried a variety.
There's very little other than certain fibers to use that will absorb the water, because you need to have something that will absorb water.
So I wouldn't drink a glass of water and... 3 days.
You have to remember, though, that the intestine is designed to absorb 99% of all fluid that goes into it, the large intestine. And so if there's anything that is inhibiting the intestine from doing that, it doesn't take much to get very loose stools or diarrhea afterwards. And so by taking some fibrous material, certain foods will have that,
I've tried the Metamucil.
Yeah, it may not be the thing to do. I can't really recommend anything that you can take right now. But the first step usually is the foods, because there are certain foods that have much more fiber than others. And the second step after that would be to see your physician to deal with any issues regarding medications that might help slow down the intestine and prevent some of that strong reflex.
Okay, we'll pick it up right after the news, 3:30 news here at CFRA. With the Wednesday House Call, Dr. Barry Dworkin is here taking your health-related questions. And how many candles were on that cake, Dr. Dworkin?
There were 50 candles.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You don't look a day over 49.
Thanks a lot.
By the way, I have to say this, I was scheduled to interview CNN's Larry King today.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that has been postponed until his publicist tells me spring 2012.
Lovely. Busy guy.
No, he was supposed to come to Ottawa for an event at the National Arts Center. We were going to do an interview. He has a memoir out, 50 years. He was in broadcasting as long as you've been on the planet Earth, Barry.
Right.
And anyway, the event at the NAC is on hold. His trip to Ottawa is on hold. He's 77 years old. Things come up. So we'll get Larry. We had him on the program once before, and it was a great conversation. It's a great interview, but unfortunately can't make it today.
Oh.
And I was broken up about it. Spent all morning getting ready for that. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. Wednesday House Call, 521-TALK, if you have a health-related question. Mike in Orleans.
Yes, hi. Happy birthday, Dr. Dworkin.
Thank you.
My question is about the actual process of the colonoscopy. I had one done a couple of years back at a local hospital. I went in, I was seen by a nurse, and I went in for the actual procedure. I was very comfortable. I was given a sedative. It all was just like a dream. I woke up in a recovery room, covered up with a warm blanket, had a little interview, and then I went home. All was well.
Right.
I took a friend a few months later to have his done, and it was done at a local clinic. And I said, well, you go in, it's over before you know it. You don't even know what happened. Well, their experience was entirely different. I understood they weren't given any sort of real sedation. It was an extremely uncomfortable experience. They were corresponding with the physician throughout the whole procedure. They remember everything like it was a very bad dream. Mine was a good dream. His was a bad dream.
Yeah, there are reports of people, depending on the places you go to, there may be different protocols and how they perform the procedure. I know that my patients that I send to one of the clinics that do specifically the colonoscopies and endoscopies, for the most part, there is sedation, and patients come back reporting that it was, as the experience you mentioned, really painless and, you know, like almost like a dream, as you said, which was pretty apt. I had the same experience when I had mine done, and it's done, and it's, you don't even know it's actually happened. So it is also imperative for patients to ask when they're going, before they go, usually there's an interview beforehand, or even to speak to their physician saying, you know, I really want to make sure that there's sedation. And that way you'll be found a place that does this. Some may not do it. Others may only provide a slight sedation. Depends on the facilities they have, because not all of them are equal. Depends on how well set up these.
Yeah. I had one of them done, and they gave me a local, I guess, is what, I don't know what you call it, but it was painless for me. Very easy.
So if he reported that he had an unpleasant experience, I mean, it's important to know that he or she should bring that up with their physician to let them know what the experience was. And then it could be the physician that calls the place, or even your friend to call the place and say, you know, do you provide sedation there? Is this something that's just not what you do? So at least there's knowledge ahead of time, because people should have a choice about where they can go, where they can get things done, and also be comfortable. So the point you bring up is very valid.
Okay, I just thought I'd bring that out, because this all came to mind with this other incident a few weeks ago where they brought up the problem with the sterilization, and I read a few reports where people said they went and they found they had very uncomfortable experiences, and it made me think back to my other friend.
Now, the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that there are individual experiences that people have. So granted, there may not have been sedation, but you're never going to have 100% of people 100% satisfied all the time. That's not to say they didn't have an unpleasant experience, but people have very subjective views of what's happened. But nevertheless, it still should be brought up and discussed to make sure that it's really determined whether this is really the case of what's going on there.
Okay, just before we get to our next caller, I have a sports injury-related question. You know, I'm following the Senators. They're right back in it now. They've won 3 games in a row. But Alfie was out last night with a hip flexor. What's a hip flexor? He's day-to-day with a hip flexor.
Yeah, it's just simply the muscle that, you know, when you lift your leg up, you know, if you're sitting in your chair now and you're lifting your knee up towards your chest, that's flexing your hip.
Okay.
Right? And so he's hurt the muscles in that area that do that. So if you think about it when you try and skate.
Are they actually in the hip?
It's on sort of along your gluteal muscles along the side of the leg. I mean, it's, they say hip flexor, but hip flexion itself is more than just one muscle.
Okay.
So there's probably a series of muscles that he pulled or strained. And those are the muscles
you just wait for that to heal up?
That's the muscle. Yeah, you wait till it heals up. You do rehab with it. But that's part of the muscles you use when you're pushing off and you're skating, or you're backing up and you know, it's basically your skating stuff. So
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go to Donna in Clayton. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, hi. Doctor. I was diagnosed with a multinodular goiter roughly 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this May, I had, in 2005, I had a nodular, the goiter, I had a fine needle aspiration.
Okay.
And they told me that I had follicular cells.
Okay.
So then I had an ultrasound in May, and they said that the right side had increased in size. Mm-hmm. The left side was the same. So my doctor sent me for another fine needle aspiration.
Okay.
And then the results that came back said that it was a follicular lesion of undetermined significance.
Right.
Now, she's going to be sending me on to a throat specialist next week. But I'm just wondering, because she wasn't really sure if that was, like, negative or positive.
Well, when they say undetermined significance, it means that they cannot prove that there are any cancerous cells. That's what they're saying.
Okay.
So it means that there's no evidence from what they can see of any cells that suggest that there's cancer. And so undetermined significance means that they haven't yet figured out how significant that is. That's all that it means. There's certainly no indication from that. Very similarly to how we get Pap test results that will say that will be cells of undetermined significance, atypical cells or squamous cells of undetermined significance, or ascus is the term. And again, that simply means that there might be some changes in the cells, but it's something that you watch because there's no evidence of any cancerous change.
Let's go to Natalie on line three. Natalie, go ahead.
Hi, Natalie. First of all, happy birthday, Dr. Dworkin.
Thank you.
Fellow Scorpio. I'm turning 45 on Saturday.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. My question is in regards to my father. He's turning 83 in January, and he was gone overseas to Europe on a cruise and came back with a sore throat and mm-hmm. lost his taste buds. He can't taste anything, so he's losing weight.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the clinic, and he had blood work, and everything came back okay. He's mm-hmm. in good health, but he's still not tasting anything except maybe just salt.
Right.
And he can't have salt because of high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
He went to our family physician, and she did more blood work, came back okay. She told him, "You're fine." And he's very frustrated, very mm-hmm. depressed. And I'm really getting worried. I'm really getting concerned of his health.
Right.
The fact that he's 82. Now, she told him, the doctor, that it's possibly caused by acid reflux. So she gave him a new medication and is sending him for a scope, the scope test to do down mm-hmm. the throat and stomach.
Right.
I've never heard that acid reflux can affect the taste buds.
No, I haven't heard that either. Has he lost his sense of smell?
No, except he can't smell. Like he smells the food, and it smells really good. Like we had turkey dinner for Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
and he could smell it, and he says, "Oh my God, that smells so good!" But he couldn't taste a thing. Like he couldn't enjoy it when it came to the tasting.
Okay.
And I'm really getting concerned that it's affecting not just his physical health, but his emotional health. Like he's really like frustrated and he's really bummed out.
If it is his taste that has disappeared,
yeah.
But he can smell, because sometimes what happens when you have some people get viral illnesses is that they get damage to the olfactory nerve, which results in lack of being able to smell, and they have diminished ability to taste food as well.
Okay.
But if his smell is normal,
yeah.
Then, which is a different cranial nerve than the taste, which is another cranial nerve that does that. And if it's specifically taste,
yeah.
and everything else is fine, then what we have to ask ourselves is, did he have, in the course of having this infection, or has he had, as maybe coincidentally, something that may have damaged the nerve that goes to the tongue that
okay.
provides taste sensation? Because it's not the taste buds that would have been damaged. You know, it just doesn't make sense for taste buds to be damaged. They're receptors, but
okay.
it's the transmission of the taste. Given that he can smell things and he smells the food but not able to taste it,
yeah.
I would suggest that he have, there's one thing to see an ear, nose, and throat physician, but it's another
yeah.
also to ask a neurologist perhaps to check and see if there's something with, I believe it's the fifth cranial nerve that provides taste, or the seventh cranial nerve that provides taste to the tongue. And that may have been damaged somewhat. So that would be another avenue to do.
Last call for the Wednesday house call is not that line. It's Ian on line two. Ian.
Yes.
Yes,
hi,
sir.
Dr.
Go ahead.
Dworkin.
Hi.
I'm 44 years old. A year ago and a bit, I had my left hip resurfaced. And I just left my orthopedic surgeon to have a consult for my right hip.
Right.
Now, I had asked him about cortisone shots. I had a couple before with my left hip,
mm-hmm.
and now he's saying that I shouldn't get one because, I mean, if you need a cortisone, you need a hip replacement, but he's also telling me it's 2-year wait before I can get it done.
Lovely.
You feel like you're just in limbo. You know, here I am. I'm self-employed. I do home improvements.
Yeah.
I need to be able to move.
Well, the answer to that is
hold on, you're going to get a house call.
Yeah, right.
I wish.
If the issue with cortisone is not necessarily that it won't help. It can help for mild to moderate osteoarthritic change in a joint. For a joint that has severe osteoarthritis,
yeah.
where there's bone-on-bone grinding, cortisone's not going to do too much. So that's the issue. So is there harm in using cortisone at least once to see if it's going to help in the hip? Most of the time there isn't. You have to worry sometimes of the cortisone affecting blood supply to the hip itself or the bone to the hip. But if you're going to wait 2 years and no one is offering you any other solution, I would say...
Do they do that in Hull? That kind of thing?
in
Oh, it's no problem getting it. You can get a cortisone shot pretty quick.
Yeah, you can get a cortisone shot anywhere. I would say, you know, if you're telling me it's 2 years, give me the shot. Let's see if it works. If it doesn't work, at least you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's frustrating, you know what?
This is something that I think frustrates everybody because it's needless. There's no reason for someone, especially now 44, who's working, to have 2 years of waiting who may not be able to work, and cost more to the system over a long time, both from a personal and societal.
If he wasn't
basis.
Working for himself and he was working for an employer that was part of the workman's compensation board, I know that's the old-fashioned term.
Yeah.
And he injured himself on the job, they would send him to Hull, and he would be fixed up in a month.
Because the workman's
compensation board doesn't want you collecting from their insurance policy and being out of work or being immobile for 2 years.
Yeah, but
they want you back up and running again.
But we have equal access for all, right,
hypocrisy.
Rob?
Hypocrisy. Total hypocrisy. That's it. That's all. Right. Special guest on the Sunday House Call.
Yes, we're going to have Dr. Andrew Pipe on Sunday House Call. He's the Chief of the Division of Prevention and Rehabilitation at the University of Ottawa Heart Institute and Chair of the Champlain Cardiovascular Disease Prevention Network. And the question that he'll be answering on Sunday as part of the Shake Your Head, you know, give your head a shake campaign for SALT is reducing sodium still considered good prevention for cardiovascular disease?
Okay.
So we're going to get into the details and the evidence for that.
Excellent. That's Sunday at 4 on 580 CFRA. Thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Good to see you. Happy birthday again.
Thank you.